Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the June 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners, one of which will be coming up this month. More than half a century ago, the blacklisted Hollywood screenwriter Dalton Trumbo produced a small pamphlet which he titled The Time of the Toad. It was a reference to a statement by the 19th century French novelist Émile Zola that before he began to read what the French press had to say every morning, he would eat a toad. After that, said Zola, he could swallow almost anything. It seems that for some time we have been living in the time of the toad, with the national media more than a match in its mendacity to what Zola and the people of France had to deal with in another age. I should add that I have a loyal listener, a KZOX member, who refers to me as the dentist, because most of the news I bring to you on Takes on the World is invariably painful. After watching the results come in from last night's primaries and hearing the inane, contentless comments of the media pundits, as well as those of the presumptive presidential candidates, it seems this is going to be another one of those painful days. Later this morning, after telling you about a few things that you're unlikely to hear anywhere else on your radio dial, I'll be taking a look at one of the less attractive aspects of American society, not disconnected from the one we are currently experiencing, that is the presidential election process. It's one that Bernie Sanders has spoken about on the campaign trail, and one which his opponent, the now presumptive Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and her husband, ex-President Bill, contributed to mightily in creating. It is America as the incarceration nation. Incarceration Nation, How the United States Became the Most Punitive Democracy in the World, is the title of a newly published book by Cornell University professor Peter Enns, and I'll be discussing its contents with him about 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. My painful week began early Monday when NPR's Morning Edition host David Greene asked radio host Nomaki Konst, a Bernie Sanders supporter, to share her opinions on the California Democratic presidential primary with Cokie Roberts, a long-established Washington political figure who is a fixture on NPR most Monday mornings. If you were listening, you heard an exchange between the Sanders supporter Konst, host of Sirius XM Radio's The Filter, and Green, in which the following comment by Konst perked up my ears. "You know," she said, "California by design in the 80s, if many listeners may recall, there was a Hunt Commission, which was sort of the counter-reform effort after a few reform commissions. And at this Hunt Commission, the establishment spoke up and said, you know, we want to have our say in the party as well, not just the voters. And that's when they came up with the idea of superdelegates. And they also put some of these primaries, the more conservative states at the beginning of the process, and more liberal states like California, all the way at the end. So even though California is the largest state, by far the most progressive state," she added, "it was put at the end to prevent a more progressive grassroots candidate, and that was actually spoken of at the commission, from taking the nomination," end quote. A remarkable statement that surely should have drawn a response other than what followed from NPR's Green and Roberts, in that they are dealing with a problem that I had never heard before discussed on the air. "Well, what about those who would say the system, maybe it should be changed," interjected Green. "Bernie Sanders could take that fight to future elections, but not this one. He's playing by the rules that are established. And you know, at the moment, some would argue the numbers are just stacked up against him. And as Cokie said, you know, numbers-wise, California doesn't matter." When Green asked for her comments on what Nomaki Konst had said, Roberts expressed not a word of sympathy or any indication that California's situation might be unjust. "Look," she said, "if you don't like the way the rules are, you could do what Jesse Jackson did in 1988 when he had won 13 states and he went to the Democratic convention and said, get rid of winner-take-all primaries and change the system to proportional, which is what happened," end quote. Yep, and what they gave the voters were the superdelegates. Well, if we have learned anything from this strange election season is that age does not necessarily make us wiser when it comes to political issues, and that there's nothing democratic about the Democratic Party. The party establishment will not give up its power without a fight, and that's what we're likely to witness in Philadelphia next month. Last Friday saw the passing from Parkinson's disease of one of the most widely recognized figures of our time, former heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali, boxing champion Muhammad Ali. Most of those who have publicly mourned his passing on the mainstream media, however, are doing the same number on him they did on Dr. Martin Luther King since the moment of his assassination, ignoring King's unconditional condemnation of the Vietnam War and our foreign interventions, and identifying America as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. In acknowledging Ali's passing, Obama spoke in general terms. He said his fight outside the ring would cost him his title and his public standing, noted the president. It would earn him enemies on the left and the right, make him reviled, and nearly send him to jail, said Obama. But Ali stood his ground, and his victory helped us to get used to the America we recognize today, end quote. I beg to differ, Mr. President. Ali's denunciation of the Vietnam War did not make him enemies on the left. Quite the contrary. Throughout much of the world, he became a hero for the ages. And to make sure there'd be no other draft resistors such as Ali and the thousands of others who refused to go to that unjust war, names known now only to their families, friends, and the FBI, President Nixon ended the draft in 1973. It was a master stroke on Nixon's part. Not only did it take the wind out of the sails of the anti-war movement, but the establishment of a volunteer higher-paid military precluded the development of popular movements against the wars that were yet to come, the wars we have today. A last word about Muhammad Ali that you will not be told or read about in the mainstream media or hear mentioned at his memorial service. He was an outspoken critic of Israel and a supporter of the Palestinian cause. In March 1974, for example, he told a press conference in Beirut at the start of a tour of the Middle East that the United States is a stronghold of Zionism and imperialism. On a visit afterward to two Palestinian refugee camps in southern Lebanon, as reported by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, he was reported by a Palestinian news outlet as saying, and quote, "In my name and the name of all Muslims in America, I declare support for the Palestinian struggle to liberate their homeland and now the Zionist invaders," end quote. I have since learned to my disgust that Ali's memorial service this Friday in his Lexington, Kentucky birthplace, that the eulogy will be delivered by Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, the incarcerator, whose anti-crime legislation, hardly endorsed by First Lady Hillary, led to the imprisonment of thousands of black and brown youth, many unjustly, largely for drug crimes. In addition to family members and representatives of six religious faiths, Turkey's increasingly dictatorial president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Jordan's King Abdullah will be among the speakers. Thus far, it appears that not a single voice from the black political community will have an opportunity to speak to the 18,000 who are expected to attend the event at the KFC Yum Arena. It may be that none wanted to share the stage with Clinton, but it's more likely the organizers wanted to continue the process of sanitizing Ali's radical history. In the same category, we could include the failure of the country's largest veterans organizations, all of our flag-waving politicians, and the nation's media to mention that today is the 49th anniversary of Israel's deadly and deliberate attack on the USS Liberty, a clearly marked Navy intelligence ship that was monitoring radio traffic off the coast of Egypt during Israel's Six-Day War in June 1967. For 75 minutes on a Sunday afternoon, 3 days into the war, Israeli jets and torpedo boats ruthlessly pounded and napalmed the lightly armed American ship, killing 34 sailors and wounding another 171 after first destroying its highly sophisticated communication systems. The Israeli claim that its flyers mistook the Liberty for a much smaller Egyptian vessel, which few senior U.S. officials accepted, was exposed as a blanket lie in 2007 with the release of declassified transcripts of Israeli radio traffic that the NSA had recorded and kept secret for 40 years. That story should have been on the front page of every newspaper in this country, but only the Chicago Tribune reported it, and you were listening to Takes on the World, you heard it about right here. Even a bigger story was the betrayal of the crew of the Liberty by President Lyndon Johnson, but that too the American public still knows nothing about. One of the Liberty's distress cables had managed to get through when the Israeli fighters were reloading, and the USS Saratoga, the closest U.S. aircraft carrier to the war zone, picked it up. The ship's commander, Admiral Geist, responded by sending a fleet of jets toward the Liberty's location, and he let the Defense Department know about it. At that time, the The nationality of the attacking force was unknown, but when the White House learned they were Israelis, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara wired Admiral Geis to tell his flyers to turn around and abort the mission. Disbelieving what he had been told, Admiral Geis then phoned McNamara and asked him if the president knew about the orders. At that point, Johnson himself came on the line, Geis recalled, and told the stunned admiral that it was his orders, saying, "I don't want to embarrass an ally," end quote, by end quote. By any definition of the word, that was an act of treason on the part of President Johnson, for which he should have been arrested, removed from office, and tried for his betrayal of the country and the men in uniform for whom he was the commander-in-chief. To compound his crime, he ordered the ship's survivors not to mention a word of it to the media on the penalty of court-martial. Thus, it was not until he retired did the ship's bridge officer, Lieutenant Commander James Ennis, write the first book about the attack, called The Assault on Liberty, which you can buy or read online, along with a number of books, other books, plus two excellent documentaries on the subject. What was the reason for the attack? There's much speculation, but what seems likely is that since the Israelis had obtained the location of all of Syria's defenses on the Golan Heights through a major spying operation, they wanted to take advantage of the war to destroy those defenses and seize the Golan Heights, which they did, again, reportedly, the wishes of the White House, and so wished to keep it secret until the deed was done. Israel's attack on the USS Liberty, on our liberty, if you will, came to define U.S.-Israel relations, establishing as a fact that the Israelis could murder Americans, American servicemen and women, and get away with it. Further evidence of that has been the years of failed efforts by USS Liberty survivors to get Congress to conduct a single investigation of the incident, which they have compared with Congress's obsessive response to the attack in Benghazi. Up to Israel's launching of the war on Egypt, France had been its major arms supplier. The U.S. contribution was limited to Hawk anti-aircraft missiles, which President Kennedy had provided Israel as a bribe to keep it from developing nuclear weapons, a bribe that didn't work. French President Charles de Gaulle had warned Israel not to instigate an attack, and when it did, he promptly cut off all further arms shipments. That's when the Johnson administration stepped in. Rather than punishing Israel, he rewarded it. It's one of the reasons I suspect behind Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu telling a group of Jewish settlers in 2001 that, quote, "America is a thing you can move very easily," end quote. He's still doing it, as this next piece of news illustrates, one that's posing problems for Washington and the U.S. media. Used to catering to Israel's interest while at the same time projecting Russian President Vladimir Putin as a threat to invade Eastern Europe, the White House and the mainstream media are having their difficulties in explaining the cozy relations between Netanyahu and Putin that have developed over the past year. How will the neocons candidate Hillary Clinton do it? Well, at the moment, they can't, which might explain why there has been so little U.S. coverage of the latest visit to Moscow of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his fourth in less than a year. This one with his wife Sarah began on Monday, ostensibly to mark the 25th anniversary of the reestablishment of diplomatic relations between the two countries, but with a loaded working agenda designed to bring Moscow and Tel Aviv closer together. According to Netanyahu's office, he and Putin will discuss with the implementation of certain understandings that they reached during his visit to Moscow this past April, along with examining the various regional issues, including, quote, the global fight against terrorism, situation in and around Syria, and the diplomatic horizon between Israel and the Palestinians, end quote. They'll be talking about bilateral economic and trade cooperation and the strengthening of, quote, cultural and humanitarian ties. Primary interest in Netanyahu is signing an agreement that starting in 2017 will see earlier emigres from the USSR, former USSR, who lost their eligibility for Russian pensions, having them reinstated, a move designed to enhance Netanyahu's credibility within Israel's large right-wing Russian Jewish community. One highlight of the visit will be the return to Israel of a tank captured intact by the Syrian army in eastern Lebanon at the beginning of Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon. Its crew became frightened when it came under attack and apparently abandoned the tank and attempted to get back to Israel on foot. They never made it, and their parents are still wondering what became of them. That's what a New York Times article about Netanyahu's trip focused on, ignoring the political implications of the warming relationship between America's loyal ally in the Middle East and its latest major global adversary. This first became noticeable when Israel refused to back U.S.-led sanctions on Russia after it annexed Crimea in 2014, a fact that the White House, the rabidly anti-Russia neocons, and the mainstream have successfully kept from the American public up to now.